asked. I realized they thought I was a junkie. They thought I shot up heroin. I never had. But if it was going to give me a job, I didn't mind, you know. What would you say to Billie Holiday if you caught her doing drugs? Asked Sydney. I closed my eyes for a moment. I'd grown up around people like Billie Holiday. I knew women like her. I knew that if I was her friend and caught her doing drugs, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't get angry. I might not like it, but I'd understand. I'd be sympathetic to her need. So I pretended to fix up some shit as I talked to her. Said, baby, how could you be doing, you know, don't be thinking you're hiding it. They gave me the role of piano man right there. They said I did great. I was very excited. I talked about becoming a movie star all the time. Not because I saw myself as a star. I just had all this juice inside me, this swirl of emotions and ideas that I felt could be brought out on the big screen. You're the greatest actor I ever seen, Mooney once said. You know why? 'Cause you can't act. I can't. No, but you sure can lie. You convince yourself of something, and then you tell it like it was true. And so it was in Lady Sings the Blues. I modeled myself after a piano player I knew from Collins Corner in Peoria named Jimmy Brinkley, and I tried not to get high as we shot the movie. It seemed to let me hold my own. Diana Ross was great, mysterious, gorgeous. Billy Dee's self-assurance in front of the camera made me jealous, though I thought he took himself way too seriously. At the end, I felt like I'd opened a new door. Suddenly, people wanted to meet me. One night, Warren Beatty and Julie Christie came to my place. We talked about movies and sheep. Julie owned sheep in England. Warren wanted me to do a movie with him. But I worried that if we worked together, I wouldn't like him as much. I accepted another offer instead. Mel Brooks called and asked if I was interested in working with him on a script for a Western. Mel and I had never met, but I knew of his brilliant reputation starting with Sid Caesar. I was excited just to talk to him. After the script arrived, I read it quickly, and Mel and I talked again. So, this is a comedy? I asked. Yes, he said. Then why don't you make it one? I joined Mel in New York, where he had set up shop in a hotel with writers Andrew Bergman, Norman Steinberg, and Alan Unger. We tossed out lines and acted out ideas each day for 8 or 9 hours. Mel acted as ringleader, saying stuff like, "Great, Richard. We'll make this guy black," and laughing when I came up with the fart scene. I knew Blazing Saddles was going to be one of the funniest scripts ever. And before we even finished writing it, Mel was talking about me starring as the black sheriff. But when it came time to make the movie, I think people at the studio more powerful than Mel didn't want me. They were scared of my reputation. Yes, I was funny. Nobody could deny that. But they also saw me as a volatile, vulgar, profane black man who wisecracked about getting high and screwing white women. It scared the shit out of their Brooks Brothers sensibilities to think about risking millions of dollars on a movie starring a person like me. I think Mel liked me, and I think he could have fought to keep me as his star. I think Cleavon Little did a good job. However, I know what kind of job I could have done. But Mel, bless his heart, had a decision to make, and he chose to get his movie made. It might have been different had Lady Sings the Blues come out before Blazing Saddles. The reviews I got for playing Piano Man surely would have changed some of those tight-assed minds. But both films were shot at the same time. Some 10 years later, I saw Mel in a bathroom at a nightclub in London, and he tried to make amends. "If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been able to do it," he said. "Don't tell me that here," I said. "Tell them that on television." And then we both laughed. Carefully. Following the release of Lady Sings the Blues, I should have been one of the hottest young actors in Hollywood. There was talk of an Oscar nomination in the press. People knew that I'd co-written Blazing Saddles, one of the funniest pictures ever. I had ideas and talent. I deserved the type of multi-picture deal that filmmakers Spike Lee and Robert Townsend would get from studios 15 years later. But that wasn't happening then. The only scripts that came my way were for low-budget exploitation films. It was as if baseball player Barry Bonds had a great season and then was forced to begin the next one in the minors. Still, I took what was available, including Wattstack's Hit and The Mac. It was frustrating not to be able to do serious work. I felt shackled, teased, and tortured by the system. But what were the options? I went to see Logan's Run, right? They had a movie of the future called Logan's Run. There ain't no niggas in it. I said, well, white folks ain't planning for us to be here. That's why we got to make movies. But we got to make some really hip movies, not movies about pimps. We done made enough movies about pimps because white folks already know about pimping. Because we the biggest whores they got. I couldn't win. In 1973, I worked on the picture, Some Call It Loving, which shot for several days at a church in South Central L.A. One afternoon, the priest invited me into his office. An elderly black man sat in the corner. The priest, oblivious to the onlooker, informed me in a grave tone of voice that several girls who'd been watching the production claimed that I'd molested them. I was as high as a bubble band, but I still knew bullshit when I heard it. "That's what they claim," I asked. "Yes," he said. "Well, they're wrong," I snapped. "I didn't molest them. I fucked them. And their dogs, too." Suddenly, the old black man perked up. As I stormed out, he asked me why I'd said that. "They're talking bullshit," I said. So I just added to it. 19. In 1973 television, normally the most restrictive medium, turned into an unanticipated land of opportunity. Flip Wilson and Lily Tomlin were launching shows. As a rule, variety shows were as unhip as vanilla ice cream. But Flip and Lily wanted their shows to have an edge, and they saw me as the guy who could add that exotic spice. For me, Flip's show was an opportunity to delve further into characters that I was developing in my stage act. During one sketch, Red Fox and I played a couple hustlers in a pool hall that reminded me of Pop's place in Peoria. Before we taped, Red gave me an old overcoat that helped me get into character. But I did so good that he took the coat back as soon as we finished. "Why do you want it back?" I asked. "Because you were funny," he said. "Do you like the coat?" "I do now," he replied. Shit. I was more inspired while working on Lily's two specials later that year. That was no doubt due to the way I felt about Lily herself. She turned me on. I went gaga over the way she dressed up in various outfits and became all those different people. I thought she was phenomenal and loved watching her work. She'd make me goofus from laughing so hard. Then she'd switch gears and inject a poignancy that made you think about the way you looked at the world. That shit was inspiring. It took comedy to a different level. I tried doing the same during a skit in which I played a junkie in a soul food cafe. Some were hoping to get both dignity and dinner. In another bit, Lily and I were a prejudiced aristocrat and a smelly wino who bridged their differences while stuck in an elevator. "I may be a wino," my character Lightning Bug Johnson stated, "but I'm still a gentleman." "Goodbye, Mr. Johnson," her Miss Audrey Earbore said. "Stay in touch." Lily and I went to each other's house a few times. She was always inspiring. We got each other. We had conversations that spiraled into the ozone. In minutes, we'd create enough characters to populate entire neighborhoods, and the deeper and funnier it got, the more I wanted to get in her pants. But nothing ever happened, and we stayed friends and admirers. The following year, Lily's second special won an Emmy Award for comedy writing. I gave mine to Miss Whittaker and Carver Center. If not for her, I never would have gotten that award. If not for her, I never would have gotten anywhere. Not that everything was hunky-dory. In 1974, after Blazing Saddles finally reached theaters, my ignorance of the law, rejection of society's rules, and general lack of responsibility caught up with me. First, I was stopped by cops one night for outstanding traffic warrants while driving Mooney's 1952 Ford, and as was my custom, I didn't have any ID on me. It wasn't a pretty picture as I tried to assure the peace officer I was who I said I was. He preferred to throw my ass in jail. Cops put a hurtin' on your ass, man. They really degrade you. White folks don't believe that shit. They don't believe cops degrade you. Oh, come on, those beatings, white folks say. Those people are resisting arrest. That's 'cause the police live in your neighborhood. Niggas don't know them like that. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over. Hey, officer, glad to be of help. Nigga gotta be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license, you know? 'Cause I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. As soon as that was cleaned up, the government kicked my ass by filing an indictment for failure to pay income taxes on $250,000 earned between 1967 and 1970. It looked to me like The People versus Richard Pryor, otherwise known as David and Goliath Part 2, Screw the Nigga. I tried to explain, but Oops didn't cover it. Neither did Sorry or I'll Try Harder Next Year. My lawyers plea bargained 4 counts against me down to a $2,500 fine and 10 days in jail. I went to jail for income tax evasion. I didn't know a motherfucking thing about no taxes. I told the judge, Your Honor, I forgot. He said, You'll remember next year, nigga. With the release of my third album, That Nigga's Crazy, I hit the road. This was breakthrough time. The LP sold more than 1 million copies and became my first crossover success. I wish I had a dollar for every person who's told me how they hid that album from their parents and laughed all night when they finally dared play it. But that's cool. That's how it was supposed to be. This was new stuff. It was like listening to Lenny. Everything was fair game. There was no turning back. I had found my groove. Not everyone approved. My grandmother told me not to use her anymore on records. Told me she didn't talk like that. I said, Mama, you forgot. Others couldn't help themselves. Backstage in Detroit, 2 black cops told me that they'd arrested a black guy who started spouting my line, I am reaching into my pocket. They nailed him for doing Richard Pryor and then finished the routine saying, Okay, spread them cheeks, put your face on the ground. Then all of them laughed. That was beautiful. In Hollywood, I didn't have to say nothing to be popular. I walked into the Daisy one night, and its owner, Jack Hansen, skewered me with his arm and proclaimed with a broad grin, Richard, you're a movie star. Now we can fuck. But that's how it went. I waved at women, and they were mine. If that was a joke, Deborah McGuire, an exquisite black model in her early 20s, didn't get it. After spotting her on a few occasions at the candy store, she ignored my pantomime pickup attempts without so much as a smile or a wink in return. Nothing. Which made me want her even more. Each time, I turned to my companions, usually Mooney or my friend David Banks, and whined how badly I wanted to leave with her. I wanted it so badly it hurt. Truly hurt. Finally, one Friday night, David said, "Man, it might help your case if you talk to her." "Why don't you do it for me?" I asked. David, who's the definition of jive, squiggled up his face. "I don't got nothing to say to her." "Don't fuck with me," I said. "Go over there and tell her I want to talk to her." That was a mistake. It was like asking promoter Don King to be brief. David was overkill. She didn't like him. However, in order to get him away from the table, Debbie offered to compromise. "If he gets up off his ass," she said, "then maybe I'll talk to him." After sending over a bottle of champagne, I walked over and let her talk to me like a dog. But I liked it, you know. Reluctantly, she agreed to drive with me back to my house for a party. I'd invited Lola Falana and some other friends. Later, Debbie confessed the only reason she had gone was to meet Soul Train's host, Don Cornelius. Even though I was bedeviled by her, Deborah didn't like me. She didn't need me. As a teenager, she had met this rich, older white man who helped her skip through the massacre. He taught her things, took her places, and she loved him. That fact alone made me insanely jealous. I telephoned Debbie as if hers was the only number I knew, day and night. The more attached she was to him, the more determined I was to take her away. It was sick. Really it was. I tried to get Debbie to hang out with me on the set of Uptown Saturday Night, but she wasn't ready to get involved with my craziness. I didn't blame her. One night, I got so pissed at not being paid nearly $100,000 in royalties owed me for "That Nigga's Crazy," I opened fire on my gold album, not to mention the wall, with a .345 Magnum. Another night, Freddie Prinze and I, after getting nuts on coke, stood in the backyard and fired round after round into the sky. The Contessa, who was still living with me, freaked out. She felt as if World War III was breaking out in the Hollywood Hills. She called Mooney and asked him to come over and calm us down. "He won't stop doing coke," she wailed. "He's crazy." You can't tell nobody not to snort no cocaine. Motherfucker's gonna snort it anyway. It took me a long time to learn that shit'll kill you. Once a big booger came out of my nose. A motherfucking black one this long. Scared the shit out of me. I said, "God damn, please I'll quit. Just let it stop." The only thing that stopped was me and Casey. One night in early 1975, we went to a party up in the Hollywood Hills. Without telling me, Casey left with a friend of mine who had become a well-known actor. They got into my car, which was parked alongside the curb, and began some kind of funny business driving lesson. Before long, we heard a loud crash. Everybody left the party and ran outside. The neighborhood was quiet and dark. However, we didn't have to look hard to see the source of all the noise. My car had crashed through a house down the hill. The tail end was sticking out. It looked like a stump from a movie. Casey and my friend were okay, but neither offered an explanation. But Mooney offered a guess. "He must have been teaching her how to use a stick shift," he said. It didn't matter to me. I bought a new car, and Casey packed up her shit and made plans to get the hell out. I don't mind women leaving me, see? But they tell you why. Fuck that, just leave, you know? 'Cause there ain't shit you can say while they're talking to you. 'Cause you know it's true. All you can do is stand there and look silly. But when the shit gets too thick, niggas got a great answer. "Well, fuck it then. Take your shit and get out." "Yeah, motherfucker. Pack this, you packing shit. Pack this motherfucking shit. God damn it. I don't care where you put this shit. I don't give a fuck where you put this shit. Shit, I'm gonna find me some new pussy." She didn't give a shit what I did or said. Somehow she made everything seem like my fault. Women come back at your ass, though. If you had 2 more inches of dick, you'd find some new pussy here. Bullshit. I know the dick was good to you. If it wasn't good, why was you hollering?
I was hollering to keep from laughing in your face.
Nothing was as terrifying as rejection. Even when it worked for you. 20. By early 1975, I was a hot commodity. And if I wanted to grab a lucrative payday, one was there for the taking. TV series, Las Vegas casinos, millions of dollars. But the money didn't interest me. I knew that if I was any good, it was going to be there regardless. Instead, I went the opposite direction. Declined everything and continued pursuing my own thing. My manager at the time didn't understand. He knew the futility of asking me to tone down the shit I did on stage, but he pleaded with me to think sensibly. He wanted those monies. What I'm saying might be profane, I explained, but it's also profound. My belief in myself was unwavering. My job, as I saw it, was to throw light where there had been only darkness. I was John Wayne taking up the fight for freedom and justice. Then Roberta Flack introduced me to Atlanta-based attorney David Franklin, the only black manager I knew of in the business, and I felt as if I'd found the guy who could help me become the hero I envisioned. We couldn't have been more dissimilar. David was straight, upright, and uptight. I was a mess, short-fused, paranoid, unpredictable. However, we had a common interest. Respect. Both of us wanted it, for ourselves and our people. We were going to break down all the barriers, as teammates. He'd block, I'd run toward the goal line. The role began during a 5-week run at the Comedy Store, my gymnasium, where I began preparing new material for another album. One night between bits, I saw the likeness of an old man I'd seen somewhere else. Somewhere in my life, you know. It was as if he was standing beside me on stage. Right there, waiting for me to notice.
Over here, Rich. Look at me.
Once I noticed him, inspiration took over. As with other characters I did, like the Wino or Oil Well, I suddenly knew everything about this wise old man who I called Mudbone. Every black town had someone like him, some old geezer who talked shit about his life experiences, fancied himself a philosopher. That first night I talked about Mudbone for 2 minutes. A month later, I did a half hour on him alone. I didn't know if he was any good as a character, but I liked him as a person. I imagined myself at that age. I was born in Peoria, Illinois. That's a city, nigga. And when I was little, there was an old man. His name was Mudbone. He dipped snuff. And he'd sit in front of the barbecue pit and he'd spit. See, that was his job. I'm pretty sure that was his job because that's all he did. But he'd tell fascinating stories. My third album, Is It Something I Said?, was recorded over a week of performances at the Latin Casino in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. The OJs opened the show. I'd never seen them. I stood backstage and I listened. They were fantastic. The place was nuts. Then it was my turn and no one would settle down. "Please take your seats," the MC said over and over, but no one listened. Finally, I walked out, grabbed the mic and said, "Will you niggas please sit down?" And they did. Then I went on and did a show that stands out as one of my best ever. Good God, there are a whole lot of niggas here today. And some white folks, too. You motherfuckers came in a bunch, didn't you? Shortage of white folks lately. You all stop fucking? White folks into yoga.
You can't
get no nut doing yoga. You have to get the pussy. They stopped fucking because some white man told them there were too many people on Earth. There's no room for him to ride his horsey. There will be no shortage of niggas. Niggas are fucking. We got to have somebody here to take over. The comedy gods have many tentacles, you know, and they swoop down and touch you at different times. But when they do, it's like salvation or deliverance. It's as close to flying as a man gets. The magic doesn't happen often, but when you're on and rolling, nothing that I've ever touched comes close. Not cocaine, not even pussy. Afterward, David Banks went back to L.A. to edit the tapes while I traveled to New York to host Saturday Night Live. In only its first few weeks, the show had emerged like a gunshot blast as the hottest, hippest show on TV. Even though SNL's cast members, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, and Dan Aykroyd, pushed the envelope each weekend, the show's producers were concerned that I might take it too far even for them. During rehearsals, writer Michael O'Donohue came to my hotel room to discuss ideas, but my suggestion scared the hell out of him, and all he could say was, "You can't do that on television." "See, that's what I'm talking about," I protested, airing my frustration over the constraints of TV. Aside from that, I never heard any discussion of censorship. No talk about holding back from anyone, including the cast, who gave me the impression they didn't listen to shit anyway. Behind the scenes, though, the network wrung their hands over the possibility that I might say, "fuck," and producer Lorne Michaels, bowing to that concern, secretly installed a 5-second delay to the live broadcast, giving NBC a chance to bleep it. If I'd known, I never would have shown up. In any event, I caught the cast's enthusiasm, and I think it was reflected in the show. Following an opening monologue, my exorcist routine from "That Nigga's Crazy," Belushi and I traded swipes as samurai bellboys who argued about which one of us got to carry a guest's luggage upstairs. It ended when I took my sword and cut the front desk in half, prompting Belushi in the only sentence he'd ever utter in English as that character to say, "I can see where you're coming from." But we really stretched the rubber band of what was normally seen on television in a skit where Chevy Chase was a personnel executive giving me a job interview. Although we began innocuously with words like dog and tree, the game quickly escalated to a tension-filled contest of racial epithets when Chevy said, "White." "Black," I replied. "Bean," he said. "Pod," I responded. "Negro." "Whitey." "R, baby." "What did you say?" "R, baby." "Ofe." "Colored." "Redneck." "Jungle bunny." "Peckerwood." "Burrhead." "Cracker." "Spear chucker." "White trash." "Jungle bunny." "Honky." "Spade." "Honky honky." "Nigger." "Dead honky." Movies were next. Although the Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, Car Wash, and Silver Streak were all box office winners, each one had its disappointments. I wasn't speaking to Billy D when we did Bingo Long. On the set of Car Wash, I was too coked out to know any better. And after Silver Streak, which began as a minor part but ended as a co-starring role with Gene Wilder, I felt I could have done better. Afterward, I was inundated with scripts, but I worried that my insurgent brand of humor didn't translate as well to the silver screen as I'd hoped. Although my funky, jive-talking characterizations gave credibility to otherwise poorly written cutouts, I still felt limited by the ideas other people had originally created, and in that way I compromised what I wanted to stand for. But then maybe I was just fooling myself by thinking there was more freedom in movies, since I was never going to find an outlet as unrestricted as the stage, just me, the mic, and the audience. You knew that, Rich. Yes, I did. So, well, there was still a little child inside me who wanted to go behind the screen as I'd done in Peoria and look for Little Beaver. And the monies. I wanted the monies. So what did you expect? More than I got? You all know how black humor started. It started on slave ships. Cat was rowing, and dude says, "What you laughing about?" He said, "Yesterday I was a king." Deborah and I went fishing in Hawaii. Since I was a child, I've loved to fish. We always argued about who was going to catch the biggest fish, and at the end of the day, we argued about who'd caught the biggest fish. However, on this particular day, we were out in deep water when she caught a motherfucker that had no intention of letting her pull him in. But she put up a fight that matched his and got him all the way up to the boat. I took one look at the motherfucker and worried that he was going to get on board and say, "You caught the wrong fish, motherfuckers. Now everyone in the water. Let's see who fillets who." You know? But this fish took a turn and then jumped straight up into the air. Broke Deborah's line. You could hear it go. Ping! We looked at each other and laughed. We'd had so much fun. We had fun just thinking about it later on. Hemingway wrote one of my favorite books about a monster fish that got away. On Bicentennial Nigger, my fourth and most political album, I tried explaining that sometimes the shit you don't get is as memorable as the shit that you do get, you know? They'll have some nigger 200 years old in blackface, stars and stripes on his forehead, little eyes and lips just jiving. And he'll have that lovely white folks expression on his face. But he's happy. He's happy because he's been here 200 years. He'll say, "I'm just so thrilled to be here, over here in America. I'm so glad you all took me out of my home. I used to live to be 150. Now I die of high blood pressure by the time I'm 52. That thrills me to death. I'm just so pleased America's going to last. They brought me over here in a boat. There was 400 of us come over here. 360 of us died on the way over here. I love that. That just thrills me so. I don't know. You white folks are so good to us. Got over here and another 20 of us died from disease. Ah, but you didn't have no doctors to take care of us. I'm so sorry you didn't. Upset y'all too, didn't it? Then you split us all up. Yes, sir. Took my mama over that way. My wife that way. Took my kids over yonder. I'm just so happy. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do if I get 200 more years of this. Lord mercy. I don't know where my own mama is now. She up yonder in that big white boat in the sky. Y'all probably done forgot about it, but I ain't gonna never forget." 21. Women, drugs, movies. It doesn't matter. One of the scariest things in life is to get what you wish for. Toward the end of 1976, producer Hannah Weinstein asked me to go through the script for Greased Lightning, a film based on the life of black stock car driver Wendell Scott. As I sat on her living room floor, she ticked off the film's different characters as well as the actors she had in mind to play them, including Cleavon Little. I heard his name and assumed he was going to play Scott. "Who do you want me to play?" I asked. She looked at me as if I was stupid. "The lead," she said. "You're going to play Wendell Scott." Well, that fucked me up. Although I complained that the only reason I made stupid films like Car Wash and Silver Streak was because they were the only scripts offered, I was blown away when a movie that seemed to have substance came along and the producers wanted me to star. Was I ready to carry a film? Said you were a motherfucker. Yeah, but I was going to be cool for about 4 weeks, back when I was a kid, hanging with my man Matt. Matt was bad, knocking motherfuckers out. Bam, bam. He was killer, Jack. Henry Hansen, though, he'd knock a motherfucker through a brick wall. Matt backed off. Then I was standing there all alone. Henry say, "What you got to do with it, little nigga?" I was just, "I come home with Matt. I wasn't doing nothing. I was gonna play some basketball. Can I go now?" The movie was shot in Madison, Georgia. It got off to a rocky start when the original director, Melvin Van Peebles, tried stirring up shit about there not being enough jobs for blacks on the production. His effort fizzled when I refused to support him. I said, "Man, I got a job. What the fuck are you talking about?" He was replaced by Michael Schultz, who directed Car Wash. It was a nod toward keeping me in line. Though I hadn't been involved, the studio worried about my volatile reputation. I was more concerned about doing a good job, and to that end, I vowed to stay clean throughout the entire movie. I rented a farmhouse on some of the prettiest property I'd ever seen, and flew my grandmother out from Peoria to take care of things. Through thick and thin, Mama was like a security blanket for me. She knew the real Richard Pryor. There was no need to pretend around her. I don't know how she felt about hanging around a movie set, but she liked fishing, and we spent a lot of time together casting our lines in a beautiful freshwater lake out in the field. One day she caught the biggest bass of her life, started to scream as if she wanted to tell Jesus himself. That was nice, Mama, wasn't it? Meantime, I hooked my co-star, Pam Grier. The first scene we shot was a romantic one with both of us in the bathtub. I tried to be truly amazing. The director yelled, "Action." Pam sang "Amazing Grace" in my ear. It was quite a scene. Pam and I stayed together for about 6 months. After the movie, we went on a romantic getaway to Barbados, where she got deathly ill after eating shellfish. Back home, we enjoyed a much healthier life. We shopped, played tennis, watched TV, and hung out. Unfortunately, our relationship wasn't able to survive Hollywood. Of the two of us, I became the star. But I was put off by how much I thought Pam believed that stardom belonged to her. In my head, there was only one numero uno, and it wasn't her. White women take more shit. You be home and shit, and you be ready to go out. You say, "I'm going out, baby." "Take it easy." She say, "Okay, toodaloo." You say that to a black woman, the bitch starts dressing too. Says, "Yeah, nigga, me too. Shit, what the fuck? You can't go out without me." After Grease Lightning, the pieces fell together. Everyone in town wanted to be in business with me. David Franklin negotiated separate multi-million-dollar deals with Warner Brothers and Universal, where I set up offices in a bungalow next door to Telly Savalas. I also had projects going with Paramount and Columbia. As befitted my new stature, I spent $500,000 on a Spanish-style hacienda on 3.5 acres in Northridge, a rural suburb outside of L.A. An electronic gate kept unwanted visitors out, while its guest house, tennis court, pool, orange groves, and a stable, home to a miniature pony, made it seem as if I never had to leave. On the downside, the estate was in utter disrepair inside and out. The rambling grounds were overgrown and forlorn. The interior was shabby and old. In a way, the house was very much like me. It looked good. It had tremendous possibilities. But it needed work. I got some money and finally bought a house. First house I ever had. And them motherfuckers who come to fix it, boy, they can kill you. Everything's $500 when they come to your house. What do you want? It's $500.
I said, I ain't told you what I want.
I don't give a fuck. It's $500.
I hired Lucy Saroyan, the daughter of writer William Saroyan, and Carol Matthau. She'd remarried Walter Matthau to redecorate from top to bottom. Some blonde actress introduced us. Lucy was smart, energetic, and friendly with everybody in Hollywood. She played with life as if it was a toy. I think she thought working for me was going to be a continuation of the party. But by the time I finished Which Way Is Up in February, Pam and I were sailing on rocky seas. I was pursuing Deborah again, obsessed with prying her from her older lover. And then I started up with Lucy. It was a circus. Pam was telling people that we were getting married. I was fantasizing about marrying Debbie, and in the meantime, I was fucking Lucy. One time when my grandmother was visiting, all three women came by to see her at the same time. They sat in the den talking as if they were friends. Pam, Debbie, and Lucy. Unable to deal with this, I hid in the bedroom and listened to them make small talk. Finally, I called my grandmother in to see how things were going.
Mama, which one of them should I marry? I asked.
She looked at me as if I'd lost my mind. I wouldn't give a nickel for any of those bitches, she said. My grandmother refused to see me as anything but the little boy she helped raise. That same visit, she tossed the housekeeper Mercy and the cook and all their helpers out of the kitchen and made dinner. Afterwards, she washed dishes and then called me over to help dry. I shook my head as if she told a joke. I was watching TV.
Mama,
I laughed.
You didn't get too big for that, did you?
She asked.
Mama, I don't want you doing that. I got ladies who do that stuff for me. I pay four people, you know? Does that mean you ain't gonna help?
A moment later, she stood over me.
And I swear to God, I never saw the skillet that was in her hand. But I felt it, that's for damn sure. She whacked me good, right over my head, like in one of those cartoons. I might as well have been 9 years old as she grabbed my collar and led me into the kitchen. I dried everything, too. Dishes, counters, floors, chairs, tears.
The press said many things about me being the new black superstar. Only one thing was certain. It wasn't easy being Richard Pryor. After the movie Blue Collar, which Paul Schrader wrote in about 2 days, especially for me and Harvey Keitel, I went straight into pre-production on my own weekly comedy variety series on NBC. When I committed to do a 10-week comedy variety series, I thought I could do something significant. I saw only the possibilities of TV as a way of communicating. I mean, 1 week of truth on TV would blow people's minds. You got 20 to 50 million people listening to the real shit every week. It's going to be a revolution in the way everybody thinks. But the reality of what the network censors allowed on prime time undercut all my enthusiasm. Because I didn't want to sell out completely, I walked into one of the earliest meetings with the show's writers, headed up by Mooney and David Banks, and quit the show. I had no heart for the censors, I explained.
You want to see me with my brains blown out, I ranted. I'm going to have to be ruthless here because of what it does to my life. I'm not stable enough.
I wasn't stable, but it had nothing to do with the censors. In August, Lucy hired her friend Jennifer Lee to assist her while decorating my house. Jennifer was a dark-haired flower who blossomed right in front of my eyes one night as she sat on the edge of a bed and played the guitar and sang. I encouraged her to hang out more often. She had depth and intelligence. She seemed to understand me more profoundly than anyone I'd ever met. I'd catch her watching me. Our eyes would lock. And I knew that she knew the shit I was thinking. She was in the guest room the night Lucy and I broke up, following a deranged night of cocaine and violence. The next morning, Lucy tried to persuade Jenny to leave too, which would have fucked me over since my house was completely torn apart. But something possessed Jenny to stay. Maybe she knew the trouble had been coke-related. Maybe she wanted me. Maybe she thought she could help me. Or maybe she simply felt safe in the morning light. In any event, I realized that she could handle herself when our first date, an Andrew Young fundraiser at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, ended in potential disaster. We'd gone with a friend and his girlfriend. In the limo on the way back, the girlfriend laid into Jenny about being white and dating a black man. Sisters look at you like you killed your mama when you're out with a white woman. Why should you be happy? Outside the door to Jenny's quaint bungalow in West Hollywood, I took her hand and gave her a gentle kiss. I'm sorry for what she said in the car, I said. I don't know what you've heard or read about me, but I don't see colors. I don't believe in prejudice. We're all people, you know. That's hard enough. And that's the truth. 22. It was weakness. The day after a plane flew over my house towing a sign that said, "Surrender, Richard," I let myself be swayed into going ahead with the TV series, though I got NBC to agree to reduce the number of shows from 10 to 4. The less, the better. I should have just taped my personal life and sold it as a weekly drama. Episode 1. Although Richard is in love with Jennifer, he proposes to Deborah. I thought Pam Grier says she was marrying you, Deborah said. She did, I replied. But that's not true. Don't worry about it. I still don't know whether I wanted to marry Debbie because I loved her, or because I figured it was the only way to bring my obsession with her to the point of do or die. Well, I first have to talk to him, she said, referring to the older man who'd virtually raised her. Okay, I said, putting the phone down. I sounded like a reasonable man, but I wasn't close. After hanging up, I numbed myself with vodka and cocaine. The demons began hammering my brain, putting in overtime. Before I knew it, I drove to Deborah's house and was pounding on her door. No one answered. I screamed. Suddenly, it opened just a crack, enough for her to look out and tell me that she wasn't going to let me in. I'll call you, she promised. A few days later, she did. Okay, she said. Okay what? Okay, you win. I'll marry you. Episode 2. On September 18th, Lily Tomlin invited me to appear at a star-studded gay rights benefit at the Hollywood Ball. By the time I walked on stage, I was out of control. I was drunk, stoned, and incensed at what I perceived to be the mistreatment of a black singing group compared to some of the white acts on the bill. When I got to the mic, I asked 17,000 of the richest, most powerful, and influential motherfuckers in Hollywood where they were when Watts burned. Then I added, "You Hollywood faggots can kiss my rich, happy black ass." I was the talk of Hollywood the next day. I'd pissed off everyone from studio heads to head waiters. Lily tried excusing my behavior, or at least explaining it by saying, "When you hire Richard Pryor, you get Richard." In the aftermath, I was sorry and ashamed. I regretted the incident. But when you're fucked up and try to make a point, something gets screwed up as the words travel between your brain and mouth. Your brain says, "You want to say something, Rich? Great. Well, first come on into the lion's den." "Oh, okay." So then you want to tell your wife that you love her, but you end up saying, "Hey, bitch, get off my back." Episode 3. The night before Richard marries Deborah, he pulls Jennifer into the bathroom and starts kissing and groping her. "You're getting married, right?" Jenny asked, confused but not resisting, and in fact already in love with me. "Supposed to be," I replied, lifting her dress. "So how come you're kissing me like this?" It was a good question. I wanted to possess Deborah, but I wanted to know Jennifer. She knew famous actors and musicians. She'd seen things. She'd been there, you know, and I envied that. I guess I want it all, I finally answered. Before we got any further, Deborah came home. Right away she smelled trouble, sniffed the funny business before she got upstairs. She wanted to fire Jenny, but I played it smooth, saying that was fine with me, but then she'd have to take over the redecorating. Knowing Deborah was a grandiose bitch who never did a day's work in her life, I prayed that she would react in character, which she did. Well, maybe we should keep her around just to finish up, she said. Good idea, I replied. Okay. The wedding, if you can call such a spectacle that, took place the next day. Barely. I was drunk. My daughter Elizabeth wore black. Pam Grier showed up uninvited, and Deborah, the bride, who was an hour late and had to be revived after taking too many Quaaludes, said, Thank God you were drunk when I got there, because if you'd seen what I looked like. The following morning I showed up on the set of the Richard Pryor show, still wearing my wedding tux, ready to tape the third of four shows. By then, I was already resigned to failure. Not only were we pitted against Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, the two top-rated shows, but the network censors thwarted me from the get-go. On the very first show, they refused to air the opening bit, a close-up of me reporting how delighted I was to have my own show. There's been a lot of things written about me, I said with a straight face. People ask, how can you have a show? You'll have to compromise. At that point, the camera panned back and showed me standing naked. I was in a body stocking, with my balls cut off. Well, look at me, I continued. I've given up absolutely nothing. With a supporting cast that included Robin Williams, Sandra Bernhardt, and Marcia Warfield, we still managed to deliver an exciting, surprising, and provocative show. In one skit, I played the first black president of the United States who's asked at a press conference if he planned on continuing to see white women. After revealing the strain of such a delicate subject, he replied, As long as I can keep it up. Then he added, Why do you think it's called the White House? The show was no vanilla milkshake. It was poignant. In one sketch, a wino returned home to his wife, who was played by writer Maya Angelou. She used her Pulitzer Prize-winning genius to elevate this takeoff on my nigger with a seizure routine into a monologue about the woeful self-destruction by black males. The show also had its share of punchlines. As a slick black evangelist with a global-sized afro, I groused about not having the crossover buck, the Billy Graham dollars. I'm proud of the effort, but the medium's limitations were as frustrating as low ratings. The show also took a tremendous toll on my health. My drugging, drinking, and relationship excesses were lethal when combined with the pressure of being a perfectionist and putting on a weekly series. I imagined resting when Debbie and I finally honeymooned in Maui, but it was nothing to put on a postcard home. I spent the first night drunk and covered with vomit in a shower while she complained about the awful condition of the bungalow we had reserved. It was old. There were bugs. And the hotel didn't provide room service. Are we going to eat cornflakes for a week? Debbie asked. I attempted to redeem myself the next evening by going to the grocery store and cooking fried chicken, mashed potatoes, and corn on the cob. But it was a temporary reprieve. At the end of October, the craziness began all over again when I went to work on The Wiz in New York. I couldn't help myself. I caroused with sleazy, doped-up, no-good-nicks all night. I was as lit as the white suit I wore playing The Wiz himself. I answered my wake-up calls by saying, Oh, shit, I made it again. I didn't realize the extent to which I was wreaking havoc on my system and jeopardizing my health until I went to Peoria in early November for my grandmother's 78th birthday. The fall weather was brisk and energizing, but I was wiped out. Too many drugs, too little sleep, too much work, too many problems. Still, I fell immediately back into my old habits, much to Deborah's chagrin. One afternoon, she and I, Uncle Dickie, and my grandmother went fishing, and in the middle of the outing, Uncle Dickie and I disappeared with what Debbie described as the two most unattractive white women ever. Dogs. She was packing to go back to L.A. when the phone rang.
"Deborah," Uncle Dickie said, "Richard's had a heart attack."
To be sure, I'd almost gone the way of my dad. Bit the bullet with an ugly whore. My heart had begun palpitating. I'd gotten sick and had trouble breathing. But even then I didn't give it much attention.
"Aye, Rich."
Then the pain arrived. It was late getting to the party. If the other shit didn't get my attention, that did.
"Oh, fuck!"
Never mind that I had been on the cover of Newsweek, or hailed by Time as the new black superstar. Never mind my latest picture, Which Way Is Up, opened that week. Never mind I had money, a mansion, women, and cars. I got my ass home and hollered like a kid.
"Mama! Mama! Help me, Mama!"
Them motherfuckers hurt. I don't care what nobody tells your ass. I was walking in the yard, and someone say,
"Don't breathe no more."
I said, "Huh?" He said,
"Don't breathe no motherfucking more. You heard me."
"Okay, I won't breathe. I won't breathe." I tried to ease a little air inside my mouth. Then I heard,
"Say, motherfucker, didn't I tell you not to breathe?"
"You told me not to breathe. Well, why are you walking? Stand still, motherfucker."
"Okay.
Get your ass down."
"Okay, I'm down. I'm down. Don't hurt me."
"Shut the fuck up. You thinking about dying, huh?"
"Yeah. Yeah. Dying."
"Why didn't you think about that when you was eating that pork, motherfucker? Drinking that whiskey and snorting that cocaine, motherfucker." My family worried themselves sick. They were probably closer to death than I was. They saw their money supply gasping for air, moaning and writhing in pain. They probably wondered if this wasn't some sick joke, me coming home to die in front of them. They weren't going to have none of that shit. Not about to lose my fame and money. They called an ambulance, told them to get into the ghetto quick, told them a white woman had been shot. I woke up in the ambulance, and I was looking at nothing but white people staring down at me. I said, "Oh, God, I fucked around and wound up in the wrong motherfucking heaven. Now I got to listen to Lawrence Welk the rest of my days." I spent 4 days at the hospital in ICU, where doctors determined I'd had a scare rather than an attack. My grandmother gave all sorts of explanations to the press, ranging from too much smothered steak and cabbage to a heart scare. No one mentioned a family history of heart disease, or the chance that my ticker didn't enjoy the white lady, cocaine, as much as I did. No one mentioned anything. The doctor simply told me to take it easy. "Remember, Mr. Pryor, moderation." "Right. No problem." 23. Our New Year's party started out like everyone else's. Debbie and I invited a bunch of friends over to celebrate as the clock ticked past midnight. We drank and snorted cocaine and kissed as the calendar changed to 1978. But none of us anticipated starting the new year with a blast. By morning, though, I was plastered. Debbie and I were also fighting like cats and dogs. Then she threatened to take off with her girlfriends, all of whom sat on one side of the living room, snickering at me. Being someone who didn't take kindly to insults on my manhood, I went for the ultimate fuck you. my .357 Magnum. I grabbed it from my nightstand table. Then I waved it in